And welcome back to Speak Up Las Cruces. For the next half hour, we're going to be talking with Christine Barber, the Executive Director, and Amanda Lavin, the Legal Director for the New Mexico Foundation for Open Government, about two cases here in Doniana County. One is an open meetings case involving the city. The other is an open records case involving the county. I want to thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Before we get into the cases, I want to give you just a moment, Christine, to let everybody know about the Foundation for Open Government, who you guys are, what you do, and how people can find out a little bit more about you if they would like to.
Of course, thank you. So we are a nonprofit that works for the people of New Mexico. We protect the laws that protect democracy. So the biggest ones are the ones that allow people to go into meetings and observe what their lawmakers and their elected leaders are doing. And then the other one is to get public records and to make sure that the public can always access those records so they, again, can make sure their government is working for them.
And I'll just tell a real quick story from my days when I was the Santa Fe Bureau reporter for the Sun News during the Richardson administration. That was sort of the early days for FOG. And the big fight back then was getting the Senate to put all of their floor sessions up online. They had invested all the money to buy the video equipment, but they refused to actually do the taping because they were afraid that senators would get caught sleeping in their chairs, which they would. I mean, not to their fault. You get older people working 20 hours a day and they sleep in their chairs. But it took probably 2 or 3 years of really intense and at times nasty debate would be a nice way to put it, with the Senate. And FOG at that time was led by Bob Johnson, who had kind of this iconic reputation among the reporters, because Bob had been the bureau chief in Dallas on the day of the Kennedy assassination. So he kind of had legendary status, but like I said, led the effort on that. Please go ahead.
Quite the leader and quite the act to follow up as executive director.
Yes, for sure, for sure. So let me, Amanda, ask you about the case against the county. I think that's probably the one that people here, anything going on with Project Jupiter, people here are interested in and want to know more about. This involves the county meeting where the decision on the IRB was made and the county went into executive session. Can you just explain a little bit what you're requesting and what the response from the county has been thus far?
Good morning. Yes, I can. And you're correct that that meeting back in September of last year where the county approved the IRBs is where this all originated. So FOG's first request for public records under the Inspection of Public Records Act was for communications that the county had received notifying them about this Open Meetings Act violation, because we had heard from a local journalist that he had attempted to, in fact, request FOG's letter that we had sent to the county notifying them and explaining why we thought they violated the Open Meetings Act. He tried to get that letter, and the county told him that it didn't exist. So I submitted a request on behalf of FOG to get all communications that the county had received about that Open Meetings Act violation, because we wanted to know the whole extent of the complaints that the county was receiving, because we know there was a lot of outcry about what had happened at that meeting when the county went into a closed session, didn't give any notice to the public why they were having a closed session, and didn't provide any sort of legal basis for that closed session. So that's one set of records that we're requesting, or that were requested and are the subject of the lawsuit. And then the other component of the lawsuit is FOG also requested emails about construction of Project Jupiter that the county is saying they can't provide because these emails constitute a tactical response plan that, if released, would facilitate a terrorist attack.
What?
And we know that exception that they're relying on doesn't apply to the emails that we've requested. So that's the other piece of the lawsuit, is we're seeking those emails because those are public records and the public has a right to see them.
JB was clearly hearing the terroristic part for the first time. Yeah, go ahead. What's your response to that?
That seems really a wild claim, and it also seems like something that could easily be deployed by somebody who doesn't want to give up records for any data center or any construction of like a utility or anything like that.
Right. That's exactly the problem, is we've been seeing agencies across New Mexico use this particular exception under New Mexico's Inspection of Public Records Act, or IPRA, to withhold records that probably don't fit that category. Now, IPRA requires, the default under IPRA is that all records of the state are public. The public has the right to inspect them. And there's really only limited circumstances where the government can say, no, you can't look at these records. And the legislature has specifically authorized agencies like the Dunyana County Board of Commissioners to not release government tactical response plans that, if released, could facilitate a terrorist attack. And it's a very narrow exception. It only applies to governmental tactical response plans. And then the county would have to show that even those plans, it's not a blanket exception for all tactical response plans, only those that, if released, would somehow facilitate a terrorist attack. So it's a good opportunity, I think, to get the courts to weigh in on misuse of this exception as just an excuse to hide public records.
Yeah, yeah, I completely agree. What is the rule for going into an executive session? Because I know they used to, when I was covering the county more often. I knew that at that time they would do it fairly frequently, and it seemed fairly informally.
I'm so sorry, I'm kind of losing you, and I couldn't hear that question.
Okay, I'm just asking, what is the requirement for going into an executive session, and what did they not meet on that?
So the requirement for going into an executive session, the Open Meetings Act in New Mexico requires the public body, or the county commissioners in this case, to provide public notice. When they post notice of their meeting, they have to say whether or not they're planning at any point during that meeting to have an executive session, and they need to, with some sort of general level of specificity, it's not a very high threshold. They don't have to say that much, but they have to describe more or less what it is they're going to be meeting about. That way the public can know, okay, this is the subject of the meeting, and this is why they're justified in holding that meeting in a closed session and not doing it in public. So kind of like IPRA, the Open Meetings Act has a specific list of exceptions of different types of subjects, like personnel matters or pending litigation, things of that nature, where the county commissioners are permitted to meet in private, but they have to say which exception they're relying on and give a general description of the subject matter of that meeting. And so what the county did here is, and what they appear to do for most of their meetings, is they put just a sort of general disclaimer on all of their meeting notices that they may or may not go into closed session for any one of the reasons outlined in the Open Meetings Act. So they don't provide any sort of specificity. And then when they do go into a closed meeting, they don't provide any further specificity at that point. They're not telling the public why they're meeting behind closed doors.
Okay.
And that is not permitted.
So I guess, what are the remedies for that? What are the remedies? What could the court order them to do?
Well, I do want to make a distinction about what our lawsuit has to do with. We are solely seeking relief under the Inspection of Public Records Act to get public records.
Okay.
So we're not seeking enforcement of the Open Meetings Act here.
That's
the remedy. If someone were to sue the county for violating the Open Meetings Act, would potentially be the court could invalidate any sort of final action that the county took at the meeting where the violation occurred.
Okay. And in your case, though, the county is just denying that the records exist. Is that right?
That is what they did. Now, I will say, we've had sort of a new development in this case just this week. Just yesterday, I received a number of records from the county. They've said that initial response that we got, where they said nothing exists, they said that was an oversight, and they've now provided some records. So we've already seen some movement on the case and some success. They've said that they're going to revisit some of their policies to make sure these sorts of things don't happen in the first place. So that's what's happened so far in this case.
When that audit of Dunyana County happened, there was a specific reference in the audit to IPRA requests sometimes balls getting dropped, that they didn't have a very standardized method of making sure that IPRA requests were followed up on. So that doesn't surprise me.
That's right. Yeah, as I recall, the audit found that there were these sort of systemic failures on the county's part to adequately comply with IPRA. And so I think it's important that FOG gets involved and sues counties or public bodies like Doñana County that have these sort of systemic failures, because it provides an extra layer of accountability. A lot of the times when these IPRA violations happen, journalists or members of the public are requesting to see public records. They don't get what they're looking for. And really, there's no light shed on the violation. Nothing changes. No one knows about it. They continue to violate the law in the same way. And so we've already seen that FOG's lawsuit has had some, hopefully, larger impact on how they deal with IPRA requests going forward.
Is there a fine or anything that the county will need to pay? Because I know that there is a fine that is like in the IPRA statute if they hold back information.
Yeah, and it's not so much a fine as it is what they call damages. Mm-hmm. So if FOG is successful in our lawsuit against the county and the judge finds that we were successful in getting the records that were unlawfully withheld, the court could fine or award damages up in the amount of up to $100 a day for every day that the county didn't comply with IPRA.
Gotcha.
Most of
Which
these
can sometimes
case-
be up in the tens of thousands of dollars. Ooh. Sorry to interrupt.
No, you weren't through. That was my fault. Most of these cases that I'm familiar with involve the county saying, yes, we have the documents, but we don't need to give them for this reason or that. It seems like it's a much more challenging thing for you when the county is just denying we don't even have those. There's one incident you mentioned earlier where you know for a fact that the document existed and the county said that they didn't have it. Is that the kind of – do you have to go to court and prove that – I guess my question is, how do you prove that in court?
Yeah, every case is going to be different. I mean, sometimes you don't know, and that's why it is so important that the government complies with IPRA, because we're all relying on what they have to say about whether or not these records that they're the keepers of exist or not, or what's out there that's going to be responsive to someone's request. So you don't always know if a public body tells you we don't have anything, you know, you don't always know. And so there may not be enough reason to go forward with a lawsuit if you don't know whether or not you're going to be able to prove that there are records. But in this case, it was pretty clear. We did know that at the very least, our organization sent a letter that they weren't being forthcoming about. So it was sort of a unique situation. I mean, in most situations, I think that when there's no responsive records to someone's public records request, assuming the requester has some sort of, you know, additional knowledge about what it is they're asking for, they can kind of put it together and say, well, you know, I think that there's no way they don't have something, and you might have enough to go forward with a lawsuit. But it can be tough, and that's why it's so important for these agencies to be transparent and actually, you know, do a diligent search for records and give accurate information to the public.
And where are you at? What is the status of the case right now?
So the lawsuit was just filed a few weeks ago. I believe the county has not filed their response to the lawsuit yet. Although, like I said earlier, we did get that initial communication from Doñana County saying, as far as the records that we said originally didn't exist at all, that was an oversight, and here you go, here are some records. So we've received those. There's been no response as to the other piece of the lawsuit, which is seeking those emails that they're not giving us, because of the tactical response, you know, plan that would facilitate a terrorist attack. So they haven't responded to that piece of the lawsuit, and we expect them to file their answer to the lawsuit in the next few weeks.
Okay, great. Anything else, Jamie, on this before I bring in Christine and we go to the city? Yeah, Christine, let's talk a little bit now about the public, the open meetings that act that you are involved with the city, and we had actually City Councilwoman Curran give us a call to at the start of the show to let us know that they are anticipating taking action to remedy this at their next meeting. But this was something that it was taking place for quite a while. Can you kind of fill us in on what was happening there?
Oh, yeah, of course. So starting in 2020, there was a the Las Cruces, in the city of Las Cruces, there was a committee called the Public Safety Select Committee, so kind of a long name. But what it did is it looked at law enforcement. And so the Public Safety Select Committee operated from 2020 until 2023. And the entire time it was in operation, it operated as what's considered a closed committee. So what Amanda had been talking about as far as having a closed meeting, this is similar, which it basically means whenever you see closed in meeting, it means no public. And so this committee on law enforcement operated without any the public, not only not being allowed to go to the meetings, but also not even knowing about the meetings. In fact, the city councilors many times over in the years that it was in operation said repeatedly on the record in meetings, we have no idea what this committee is doing. We have no idea what's happening. And if you look at kind of what why the committee was formed, it was all very nebulous as far as what its goal was.
Well, my co-host, not with me today, but Peter Goodman reminded me of why they actually set this up in the first place. There was a big effort at that time that he was involved in and in a way leading to try to get a citizens review board or citizens advisory board for the police department. And the mayor at that time was 100% against that idea. And this public safety committee was what he created as sort of a, instead of doing that, we're going to do this kind of thing. So that was the reason it was started in the first place. And I think the reason council members weren't aware of it, I wasn't aware of it either. I mean, I remember when that happened, but I don't know when they were ever holding meetings and whatever became of them. And I was a little surprised when I saw your case, because I remember way back when that it got formed, but I thought it had disbanded and gone away a long time ago.
And so it did disband in 2024, but it was literally a secret committee that operated for 3 years. And that is in complete violation of the Open Meetings Act, which was created. It's our state law that was created to stop this exact thing from happening. Now, and so the public not being aware, the city councilors not being aware, nobody being aware of what this committee was doing, that's our definition of a secret committee.
Now, their defense is that the committee didn't have the power to actually do anything. They couldn't write any. They were strictly an advisory committee. Like you say, it's a little strange that they would have an advisory committee that the people they would be advising weren't aware of. But what is the response that, you know, it would be okay to meet, to have a committee meet in secret if they don't have any real powers to pass laws?
You can have a committee that is created by a city council that is only there to advise the city council. Every recommendation it gets sent to the city council, and the city council discusses it and approves it. There's a second kind of committee that can be created where the city council decides something, and it's the committee's job to do the work of the city council. That is not what this committee was doing at all. In fact, I spent more than a year kind of investigating this. There is no evidence at all, and the city admits this, there's no evidence that any recommendation of any sort was ever sent from the Public Safety Select Committee to the city council. And so a committee that exists without having any oversight at all from the supposed city council that created it, there's a lot of red flags there. Additionally, there is evidence that they were doing things and creating what is called creating public policy. I mean, every time they're discussing something, that could impact the public, that could really have an effect on people's lives. That is something the public has the right to see and observe. And they were doing that. If you look at some of the records they did keep, which are not complete, but they were rewriting ordinances. It looks like they might have taken votes on things and decided amongst themselves kind of what they were doing. Now, this committee included 3 city council members, and the rest was chief of police, fire officials, things like that. But that still is not a committee that's operating for the government. That's a committee operating in by itself alone. And so it's kind of hard to justify how it fit into the dynamic. Additionally, in looking over, which I have watched hundreds of meetings, I did transcripts of more than 250 city council meetings over the years. If you look at the pattern, on several instances, there is a discussion where the city council wants to discuss something. Oftentimes it was the Citizens Review Police Oversight Board. And they were literally told, you cannot talk about this. This has to go to the Public Safety Select Committee. If the Public Safety Select Committee agrees this is an appropriate topic, it will send it back to you, but you cannot discuss it. They were told that literally on 3 occasions.
By the mayor?
Yes.
Okay. Didn't know that. That's all new information. Please go ahead.
Yeah, and so that is a pretty significant. That is a pretty significant evidence that the Public Safety Select Committee was a policymaking committee. It was directly telling city councilors it can't discuss certain things until this committee discusses this. This committee that does not report back to the city council, nor does it ever forward anything to the city council. So it was pretty clear that they were definitely trying to make sure that certain topics weren't discussed, and that they went to the committee first. They went to the committee. I don't know about first, but
so they essentially were giving them veto power over what the council could and could not consider regarding the police department.
Yes, in at least 3 cases. Yes. It's on the record. It can be seen in the city has all of its meetings online, and then also in our letter we say the exact dates and everything if people are interested in looking it up themselves. And the letter can be found on our website at nmfog fog.org.
Assuming that the city council does what they say they're going to do and they go in and rescind this committee at their next meeting, is that the end of it, or are there
it
still
might not be?
Yeah, go ahead.
So in January of 2020, in anticipation of making this committee, they changed the ordinance to allow select committees like this to be just created by the mayor and or the city council. But the reason that it is a problematic policy is when it allowed for this committee to exist. But there's an addendum at the bottom of it that says basically any members of this committee do not have to follow the ethical standards of the city if you look at the statute. And so the members of the board of any select committees that are made are by this ordinance not having to follow the the no gifts policy, the no showing preference policies, things like that. So that's why the ordinance is a problem and needs to be repealed. And I am really so happy that the Las Cruces City Council is hopefully going to do that. But it might not be the end of it for them, because the Attorney General's office did investigate this situation back in December of last year. November, they did determine at that time that they did not have the evidence to actually say if there had been any wrongdoing. Given our extensive investigation, which included looking at more than 500 emails and hundreds of hours of looking through transcripts and meetings and other notes, we have asked them to reopen the investigation for them to look at it again, because this is an incredibly serious violation. We have not heard if the Attorney General's office has decided to do that. They are the enforcement enforcement part of this picture. So they are the ones who can say if there has been an actual, if there has been something that is an enforceable thing, which if they determine that there is something that the city did do wrong, an interesting aspect of the Open Meetings Act is that it's not the city that would actually bear the burden. It's the individual city councilors who were part of the committee that would. So they would be the ones who would be, could potentially have to pay the fines. And they are the ones who could potentially be charged with a misdemeanor. If the Attorney General's office found that it was serious enough, and if they decided to go that route, that is a lot of ifs, and yeah, it probably would not happen, but that is the difference. It's a pretty significant difference, which is the Las Cruces would not be, the city would not be held liable. It would be the individuals who were on the public safety committee who would be liable.
Well, and that's why I asked the question. I mean, because you would think that, yes, it's a good thing that they're ending the committee, but if they had been operating illegally, that obviously should. Okay, we are down to our last 3 minutes. Let me go back to Amanda real quickly on your case and the case with the county records. What is next on that? Can you kind of real quickly let us know what we should be looking for coming up?
Sure, absolutely. So I think probably depending on how the county responds to our lawsuit, which we expect they'll do in the next couple of weeks, we're going to move forward with filing a motion with the court and asking the judge to rule that the exception that they're relying on to withhold the emails, the tactical response plan exception, that if release would facilitate a terrorist attack, we're going to ask the judge to find that just as a matter of law, we don't even need to get into the evidence here, that these emails do not even meet that threshold requirement of being a tactical response plan developed by the state. So we'll be going to the judge in this case and asking them to make that ruling and to release those emails.
Okay, well, go ahead, Christine. Oh, I thought I heard you jump in. Once again, we've been talking with Christine Barber and Amanda Lavin from the Foundation for Open Government. Christine, please let people know how they can stay in touch with you, how they can find out more about what you're doing.
Of course. Everyone is would hopefully check out our website, which is NM for New Mexico, NMFOG for NMFOG.org. We also run a helpline for those who are having a hard time accessing public records or have, had a hard time being allowed into an open meeting where the public is supposed to be there. And that helpline number is 505-764-3750. Thank you.
Well, thank you both so much. These are both cases that are very important to us here in the community and that we will be following very closely. And we appreciate all the good work that you're doing.
Thank you so much for having us on.